Welcome to a Friday edition of the Bulwark Podcast. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we are lucky enough to have one of our contributors, Kim Whaley, constitutional scholar and all-around pundit, joining us the day after Thanksgiving. So hope you had a good holiday, Kim.
Oh, I did. Always a special time of year, I think.
Okay. Of course, listeners should know this is a complete scam since we're actually recording this on Wednesday, and who knows what could have happened. So, you know, if in fact you woke up today and found out that the White House burned down because of an overcooked turkey and you're wondering why we didn't mention it, it's because, well, we're pre-taping it because in the spirit of the holiday, we are taking Friday off. And I've done this. I can't remember the last time I worked the Friday after Thanksgiving. So, I don't know. You work all the time, Kim.
Yeah,
so.
I can't really keep track of that, the days I work and the days I don't work. But
yeah, I know.
But I always find time for R&R. We slip it in there. So, well, tomorrow will be my day.
Maybe it's just the nostalgia for that four-day weekend that we used to have, because I'm on the same schedule where I'm working all the time. But that four-day stretch is just something that I want to have those just a little bit of refresher days, because you know that it's going to just get crazier when we come back.
Well, and it's also the olden days, as my kids would say, when we had rotary phones and we didn't have nonstop 24/7 access. So it's really difficult to not work when you're on a 4-day weekend these days, even if it is a 4-day weekend, because we've got our little phones and laptops pinging at us all the time.
You know, it's probably an overcovered story, but I think it's underappreciated. Yep. Because I do remember, I am old enough to remember, when you were off, you were off, and you had that feeling of relaxation, that moment where you left work, you got in the car, and you realized that you were going to have several days off and you weren't going to have to do anything. And yet you're never off anymore, particularly with what we do. There's never that moment. So, we have not actually upgraded our lives, have we?
No, I mean, I remember when you're on a road trip and you had to make a phone call and you'd have to find a gas station with a payphone, or when I was in high school and there was call waiting and I'm one of five kids and you had to take your turn to actually call a friend. I think there was something much simpler and easier about just not having so much 24/7 access. But as you note, we've got breaking news, so to speak, nonstop. So if you miss a few hours in our business, you might have missed something important. So it's hard to not keep checking.
Every once in a while, one of our guests will say that they've just gotten back from a vacation where they had unplugged. And I'm always somewhat envious that they could go a week or a few days completely unconnected. You know, assuming that they're in fact telling the truth, because earlier today, and of course this would be, you know, well, I had a short window between doing a podcast and having to go and do a quick MSNBC hit. You know, you're on mm-hmm. CBS all the time, so you know what that's like. So I had to rush out of the house to get in the car and go down to the studio. And about 3 minutes on the road, I realized I'd forgotten my phone.
Oh.
And I have to say, and I'm not proud to admit this, I felt like an addict. My hands were shaking. I mean, it was like, yeah. I felt completely disconnected from the world. And yet it was a 20-minute drive. It wasn't that,
right.
It was just the reflex was there. And I swear I found myself reaching for the phone occasionally, like somebody who's had a leg amputated and still can feel it. I mean,
I know the feeling. And I think people don't understand too, with this punditry business, sometimes you will be sitting there ready to go on air and the news comes out within 30 seconds before you are supposed to react to it. I think people expect or assume that there's, you know, pre-taping, or you get the questions in advance, or you can actually think about things. And sometimes you can't. So without your phone, you might be sitting there blinking like you don't know what's going on. And that's not a great feeling, because you don't know what's.
That is not a great feeling. So there's a lot of things I want to talk about, including what will happen next week when the impeachment procedure goes to the House Judiciary Committee. And we've had almost on an hourly basis, new revelations about what the president knew, when he knew it, what the hell Rudy Giuliani was really up to in the Ukraine. But I wanted to start off with something that you and I had a quick exchange about on email, because I'm still being ratioed on Twitter on the subject of Mayor Pete and whether or not he is a lying MF-er. And by the way, for listeners, I assume that people know all the terms, but ratioed is a little bit esoteric. Not because it's complicated. It's when you put out a tweet and you get way more people responding and dunking on you than retweeting or liking you. So this is the story of, it was an article in a publication called The Root, attacking Mayor Pete for an interview or something that he said at a forum back in 2011, where they were talking about the problems of inner city education. And it's a longer answer, but what he was really dragged for was suggesting that young African Americans, and I assume this applies to everybody, but young African Americans needed to have some sense that their education would pay off, that there was, that they would hope that there would be rewards for education. And unfortunately, too many, young people did not have role models, people who could model the rewards and successes of an education. And for some reason, the writer for The Root, well, not for some reason, headlined this, that this was, you know, Mayor Pete was a lying MF-er. This was a bald-faced lie, because the problem had nothing to do with role models, per se. And then he went on to tell a very compelling personal story about his own education, which is very, very powerful. But what struck me about it was that rather than take the opportunity to contrast their perspectives or have a discussion about the culture and the institutions that contribute to bad education, what we saw was cancel culture, and that Mayor Pete, because he's a white male, clueless guy, privileged background, was lying about what was going on. And it was kind of an oof moment for me.
Yeah, no, it struck me as well. And I'm actually happy to have the opportunity to talk about it, in part because I'm a mother of teenagers. And I think most older people don't understand how this cancel culture is real for young people. And what it really means is, if you say the wrong thing, even inadvertently, if you misgender someone, use the wrong pronoun, if you sort of are singing along to a song that has a racial slur and you're not of the race that the artist is, but you inadvertently sing the song along with other people, you can be labeled racist, not sensitive enough, whatever. And then you get canceled, meaning you get labeled some pejorative term and you can basically be blackballed from your community, whether it's high school, college. And I find it deeply, deeply disturbing. First of all, because it's the whole concept is untethered from a value system. I understand that we need to be respectful of other people, but it's really it's not about compassion, caring, bringing people into a conversation where they can be enlightened, spreading knowledge about what people's experiences are, all of those things that we try to teach our kids. But also it creates a culture where people are afraid to speak for fear of being retaliated against. And once people feel that their speech is limited, then their thoughts are limited. And then we lose our humanity. And it's really a problem, frankly, primarily from the very far left, in terms of what I call language police. And I understand we have to be sensitive to how people react to things. But the third piece is, of course, life is really hard and tough stuff happens. And the idea that the world is going to manage how they react to you so that you don't feel things, I think is putting our young people at a real disadvantage when life just knocks you down.
Well, so here we are. We're two white people. I'm an old white guy talking about all of this. And part of this culture is to question, the validity of our opinions on all of this. And I am willing to say that there are a lot of experiences that I have not had that I perhaps do not fully appreciate. And that when, someone suggests that we need to have a conversation about race, I agree. I do think, and I do think we can learn from one another, but a conversation about race and having a dialogue means expressing opinions back and forth. And this is what really shocked me, because what Mayor Pete, and I'm, by the way, not supporting him or carrying water for him, but it seemed like it was a thoughtful answer where he's saying, you know, part of the problem is that to motivate young people to study, you know, you have to show evidence that it's going to work for them. Okay, so he's expressing this opinion. And yet in the root, and this thing was tweeted hundreds of thousands of times, he was, you know, basically saying that, you know, this is racist, this is a sign of his cluelessness, and that he knew that it was false. So we either can have a conversation about race or we can shut up about race. And I do think that there is more and more people have just basically, they roll their eyes, they shrug their shoulders and say, look, you know, there's a designated number of opinions I'm allowed to have. And nobody wants to hear my opinion if it does not fit this. And number two, instead of having a conversation with me, I'm going to be labeled and I'm going to be stigmatized. And I have to say that I have been for a long time, but I think it's increasingly troubling how much of the dialogue that we get back in this cancel culture is simply to say, well, Kim Whaley is a white woman, Charlie Sykes is a white man, and therefore not confronting the complexity of your argument or your life experience, but simply reducing you to your gender and race, and how this is acceptable in progressive circles.
Well, it's promoted. And I mean, and I read that piece and I agree with you a couple things. One is, as a white person, it's impossible to have real sensitivity and understanding of what it's like to be an African-American person in American culture. It is a racist culture for sure. So I can't pretend that my experience is one that I can speak for that unique experience. Number two, though, is I think the author suggested that Mayor Pete was saying that it was a one-note problem, right, with respect to the problems with education amongst African Americans, and he made the point, and I think it's absolutely valid, that there just aren't resources, that the public schools are terrible. We have a lot of racism that's endemic in culture, that white privileged, particularly males, have an advantage that other people don't in this society. And it's absolutely true. And it's really, really very problematic, but it's complicated. I don't think Pete was saying this is the whole thing, number one. Number two, I think he was saying it from the standpoint of compassion. And this gets back to values. Showing compassion each way brings us closer. Attacking each other brings us away. We know this in our regular relationships, or what, you know, if you freak out and get really reactive, even with someone you care about, that the conversation is done. So that's number two. And number three is the headline that he was lying. He might have been misspeaking and speaking from a position of where he didn't have the experience to be able to say that. But lying is a very strong word, especially in a world where the president of the United States is lying. I know we'll get to this. Republicans are lying about a core narrative that has deep implications for the Constitution. So we have to be really careful about calling out lies that aren't lies. I think lies versus facts, something that's getting mixed up in our culture, and it's very, very damaging.
Yeah, and at this point, we had to mention that Mayor Pete rather extraordinarily picked up the phone and called the author of this. And I talked about this with John Harwood the other day here on the podcast. And you know, generally, I think that if someone calls you an MF-er in print in this particular way, with these very harsh personal terms, most people are going to be inclined not to pick up the phone and have a friendly conversation. And he did, which is to his credit. But again, on this issue of race, I guess maybe because I've dealt with it from different angles for so many years, sitting here, you know, watching, you know, being denounced for, you know, being a racist, for questioning this article, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My wife worked for years at an inner city Catholic school here in Milwaukee. I was very, very involved in the school choice movement here in Milwaukee because the inner city schools were so lousy. And I'm aware that the issues are incredibly complex, but this was one of those, again, the reductionism here, the reducing all of the complexity to just institutional racism. Yes, institutional racism is very real. It's very pernicious. We perhaps have underappreciated that. We, being white conservatives, you're not a white conservative, but And yet to play the card all the time and to insist that anyone who raises questions about the choices people make, to label them as somehow clueless or bigoted, you know, does contribute to the siloing that we have in our society. And
well, I think about my grandparents on my mother's side. My grandmother her family came from Ukraine, of all places, on Ellis Island in the early 20th century, 13 children, 7 of them survived. And, you know, she was raised on a farm, one room schoolhouse. She plowed the fields with a Clydesdale horse as a 10-year-old, never got beyond a 7th grade education. Her parents never spoke English. And my grandfather, he was a self-taught engineer, but also didn't get beyond a 7th grade education. I mean, these are people that for sure use terminology that we would find deeply, deeply offensive today. But they were the kindest, most generous, most humane. I learned so much from them about how to live in the world. And I guess my issue with it is to label people and take away their individual humanity as somehow they're canceled as people because they made a mistake. And we all make mistakes. It's the human condition. That's the piece that I have a problem with. And it's not just race. It's about, you know, gender, sexual orientation, all kinds of things that are shifting. And what I say to my children, you know, if the grandma and grandpa were here, they just don't understand what it means that to be, you know, a cisgender versus transgender. I mean, and some of us, even at this stage in our lives, we weren't raised with this terminology and with this sensitivity. And then people need to be patient with others, some of us that I really do want to have compassion and understanding. But as you say, if you're canceled by using the wrong terminology off the bat and you're dehumanized, then the conversation's over. It's done.
No, you're exactly right. And it is intended to shut down the conversation. This whole debate about, you know, again, Mayor Pete saying back in 2011 when he's running for mayor of South Bend, Indiana, that we need better role models, that we need more hope. I'm not sure how that's the worst gaffe in the world, but and then being attacked for it reminds me of the debate that we had back in the 1960s when Daniel Patrick Moynihan, before he was a senator, wrote, you know, basically said, we need to address the issue of family formation and the breakdown of the black family and its contribution to what we're seeing in the central city. And of course, this set off this massive backlash, including an entire book called Blaming the Victim. And there was this pushback against ascribing any responsibility to culture or choices that individuals made. And it really took, you know, 20, 30 years to begin addressing the price that was paid. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan was in effect canceled back in the early 1960s among progressives. And I think that the consequences of that were negative. Look, I think that Mayor Pete has a much more nuanced, I don't agree with him on everything, a much more nuanced opinion than he was characterized. But I do feel we're kind of going through the same process. And by the way, for the listeners, the main accusation against him seems to be that this was, as you point out, the one note that he was just saying, well, you know, if black kids had better role models, then everything would be okay. Well, that's not what he's saying. And he actually has a thing called the Douglas Plan, which is very detailed. He's got a very long section where he talks about too many children of color are denied educational justice for lack of adequate resources, to critical teacher shortages, to discriminatory disciplinary policies that reduce the instruction time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he obviously deals with that in a more complex way. Okay, I want to, in the time that we have here, let's look ahead. The House Intelligence Committee is done with impeachment. House Judiciary Committee will start the hearings next week. And at least my understanding is that rather than having fact witnesses, they're going to have a group of academics testifying. What do we see? We're not clear whether or not the White House will participate. So, Kim Whaley, what are we expecting to see next week?
Well, I mean, they did this with the Clinton impeachment process as well. I think that we don't know who the witnesses are yet, as far as these constitutional experts. I can talk about, you know, where I think the wiggle room is. There's a debate, for example, the word bribery is in the United States Constitution as a basis for impeachment. What does that mean? Ironically, I think some more conservative lawyers are saying it means the bribery statute in 1962, as construed by the Supreme Court in the past few years, you know, when I say ironically, because many conservative jurists, most are originalists, and the question would be, is it the definition of bribery in 1788, which was really about abuse of power? So I think it'll sort of try to define what the terminology is, what the standards might be. We don't know, for example, what the burden of proof is in the Senate. For a criminal process, the burden of proof would be beyond a reasonable doubt. It means it's really, really high. But historically, it's for purposes of the Senate, it's whatever each individual senator thinks it should be. So it could be a preponderance of the evidence. It could be meaning I'm 51% sure that the president did this. I assume these are the types of questions. In addition, I should note, and I've been saying this for a couple of years now, as you know, Charlie, talking about the implications of impeachment, why it's so vital, why to actually pull the lever of power in the legislature in order to preserve democracy. I mean, 2/3 of the American public can't name the three branches of government, according to an Annenberg study in 2015, that is legislative, judicial, and executive. How can the American public understand the implications and whether this is fair to Trump if they don't even know how the system works? So I'm hoping it's an education in civics. That being said, a lot of Americans don't get their news from original sources. They get their news from places that, speaking of lies, feed them a lot of lies, and they can't be blamed for believing them.
So what happens to the trickle of new evidence that seems to be coming in? We have more timelines about when the military aid to Ukraine was in fact suspended. It looks like it was July 25th, the same day as the phone call. We have the New York Times report that President Trump in fact knew about the whistleblower complaint before he reversed course and released that aid. We're finding out that employees in the Office of Management and Budget may have resigned because they felt that what was going on was illegal. We're getting more stories about what Rudy Giuliani was doing. So,
money for access. That's quite serious, right? If you want access to the Ukrainians, if you want access to Bill Barr, the Attorney General, you need to pay. I mean, that's
amazing. Okay, now that's
I just don't know where the line is. Where is the line? Where's the red line for the Republican Party where this is too much? I mean, it's hard to even is it basically executing people that are political rivals in the United States? I mean, I you know I think it's hyperbole. I don't know. I scratch my head on that one.
Yeah, well, my friend Nicole Wallace has suggested that it would take a dead hooker at the bottom of the river, but I don't think that would be enough. There's always a way around that. But what's interesting to me is the extent to which the accusations of corruption that were going on in Ukraine, how much of that is complete projection? That what Trump and Giuliani are accusing the Bidens and others of doing is exactly what they in fact were doing. And the more that we find out about it, the deals with, what are these guys, Lev Parnas and the other guy whose name I should know. Levin Igor. I mean, their schemes that they were cooking up, this latest report that Giuliani wanted to be, you know, paid by the Ukrainian I mean, it's the level
of corrupt sleaze. The corrupt prosecutor, right? So the corrupt prosecutor and the two thugs that are indicted in the Southern District of New York, that was Team Giuliani that were acting on behalf of Team Trump. And meanwhile, we also know, we heard that Putin, Vladimir Putin, planted this story a year ago that the Ukrainians attacked the 2016 presidential election. And it's just really scary that we have American politicians that are doing that, Putin's bidding, and spreading that falsehood. I mean, I say it's a falsehood because the experts that testified, including Fiona Hill, said it was a falsehood. These are people that have lived in this world for years and years as experts on behalf of the United States and say, no, there's no fact here. This is not real.
Part of the problem is where do you look? There's so much to look at there. The point you just made, the fundamental betrayal of accepting Vladimir Putin's word and doing his bidding, becoming a dupe of Russian propaganda, especially going into an election where it is the obligation of the president to defend this country from foreign attacks. So that's number one. Number two is all of the sleaze that we are seeing that Giuliani and his cronies were engaged in. And number three is the fabulism, is the fact that the president of the United States and many of his supporters are pushing a absolutely, and I'm struggling to come up with a word stronger than false, completely made up story, conspiracy theory that at some level they must know is false, but which apparently they feel is effective in gaslighting America. So, you know, where do you focus on the fact that they are, you know, pushing these bizarre stories, the fact that there's a fundamental betrayal of national security and caving into the Russians here, or just the swamp of corruption that's being exposed?
Yeah, and this is why, back to your question on what's going to happen next week, I mean, and for the sake of the listeners, why does this matter? We have a three-branch system of government where the president, we heard this, is not above the law. Well, the other two branches check the presidency. The judicial branch is out because you can't indict a sitting president, according to the Office of Legal Counsel, the Department of Justice. The only way to do it is through the Congress. And I think we're in this moment where Trump's strategy, his defense is, you know, he's going to push it and push it and push it and say, I am invincible. I'm untouchable. There's nothing that can come out that will hold me accountable. And what people need to understand is we are watching the office of the presidency, the democracy that we take for granted, morphing, being distorted and changed before our very eyes. We will have a mega presidency and two, right now, one legislative branch potentially that's like a little baby that doesn't really have any power, and a judicial branch that the Trump administration is attacking as well for issuing rulings that say he's not a king. And this is, we cannot take for granted that in the next term, if he gets a second term, we will see dramatic violations of individual rights. And this kind of gets back to the cancel culture discussion. I mean, I don't mean to suggest we have to be, shouldn't be sensitive to the words we use, but the stakes are much bigger. If we lose our democracy, we lose an accountable government, it's going to seem quaint that we had the conversation about Mayor Pete's comments. That will seem quaint.
You mentioned this rather dramatic federal court ruling earlier this week in which the judge said the president is not the king, that the notion, the claim of absolute legal immunity was essentially fictitious, that it did not exist. That, of course, is going to be appealed immediately. Any sense of, number one, the timeline, and number two, whether the Supreme Court will the Supreme Court will come down on that issue?
He's the Trump administration will absolutely lose. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll lose. Now, listen, first of all, Judge Bates, John Bates, who was my colleague in the Whitewater investigation, he was deputy independent counsel. He worked with Brett Kavanaugh. He worked with Rod Rosenstein. He was also my boss at DOJ. He's a federal judge in 2008 under the Bush administration involving challenges to House Judiciary subpoenas for Harriet Myers and John Bolton, then chief of staff for George Bush. They said, listen, Congress that wanted to look into the firings of U.S. attorneys, or if you remember that flap, the George Bush fired U.S. attorneys. And those two witnesses said, sorry, we don't have to. The presidency is, we have absolute immunity by virtue of working for the president. And John Bates said, no. So this has been already decided in 2008. And he said no for a number of reasons. One, there is no such thing as absolute immunity from testifying for the president of the United States. How do we know this? Because Bill Clinton had to testify in a civil deposition. We also don't have absolute immunity for the president of the United States from having to turn over information, documents, and other sources. Why? Because President Nixon, in response to a United States Supreme Court decision, had to turn over tapes of Oval Office conversations. We're not talking some low-level person in the White House. We're not talking even his White House counsel or national security advisor. We're talking words out of the president's mouth in the Oval Office had to be made public. If the president does not have absolute immunity from responding to subpoenas. How in God's green earth can we say that Don McGahn or any of these other multiple witnesses get to basically not show up at all? There's no basis in the law for it, except for some, again, OLC opinions that are self-serving. It's the fox guarding the hen house. And that was the case with Bill Clinton issuing the infamous memo saying you can't indict a sitting president. Those lawyers work for the president. And of course, those lawyers are going to say, you know, president's minions can't testify. I just don't see any, unless the United States Supreme Court's going to reverse United States versus Nixon and Clinton versus Jones, the two last Supreme Court decisions that said no to presidents who wanted to avoid process. I don't see even this conservative court going with Trump on this one. I think the lower court judges, including John Bates, are 100% right on this. This is not even a gray issue in the law.
So what's going on with the inspector general? We have reports out that the inspector general is going to be dropping another report, apparently debunking many of the claims that the FBI had planted a spy within the Trump campaign. But there's been some unhappiness expressed from folks within the Department of Justice that the inspector general, his name is Michael Horowitz.
Yes,
Michael Horowitz has been selective and perhaps a little bit cautious in some of the things that he's investigated, not investigated. So what are you expecting to hear from the inspector general? And of course, then there is that other, the Dunham report that will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. What should we be looking for?
Well, I think one question is why we're even getting leaks on this stuff, because the inspectors general are traditionally they're neutral. They're hired to basically not be for a particular president. And I think Michael Horowitz is one person that maybe Trump didn't sort of get to in terms of sort of putting somebody in there that's just going to do his bidding. I think where we will see a mixed outcome from what we hear, we're not going to see a report that is damning of the FBI that says it's, you know, a deep state conspiracy and lots of crimes committed. But it also sounds like there was at least an email that was amended or doctored by someone that was attached to the request for a wiretap of Carter Page. I haven't seen, of course, nobody's seen the IG memo. So maybe that's not accurate. If that's the case, that's a problem. FBI agents and people in government should not be amending facts. I mean, I think that's abhorrent. But I don't think we're going to see some sort of, you know, smoking gun that's going to take the U.S. Congress off the trail of what's happening with the president. And that's really the issue right now for the American people, the person with all the power, not the people with some power.
Now, as we're having this conversation, we've learned that William Ruckelshaus has passed away. And this is one of those flashes in the past that he refused to join Nixon's Saturday night massacre. He was the first EPA chief. He was the deputy attorney general when he was asked to fire Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. He's 87 years old and he's passing. And it's kind of interesting that it raises the question, okay, are people who are in the government right now, in the Department of Justice, do they want to be remembered? I mean, how do they want to be remembered? And they ought to pay attention to how Bill Ruckelshaus is being remembered, because his entire life is really defined by his standing on principle and his refusal to become part of the Nixon obstruction of justice. And this, but this has been a question that I've had in my mind over and over and over again. We probably discussed it, is why more folks are not concerned about the way the verdict of history and the way they are going to be remembered.
Or I would reframe it a little bit too. Why aren't more people making decisions about their own core value system? You know, how do you make decisions in your life? And we talked about this earlier. Respect for other people, humility, courage, honor, decency, truthfulness, and courage, even though it might get you in trouble, right? So Ruckelshaus basically said, listen, I'm not going to execute the president's directive to start firing people, so he's no longer under investigation. And what I tell people is it takes heroes sometimes inside government. We talk about, we talked about the whistleblower. That person did something based on principle. I know a lot of he or she is reviled by millions of Americans who support Trump. But at the end of the day, if you act based on your own value system, you will not consistently be popular. You don't always get to the head of the class. And I don't know the answer to that, Charlie. I don't know what's motivating people to not listen to their conscience. You know, I know there's a lot of writing in the Bulwark around this. Republicans, basically, self-survival is more important than principle and courage. But, you know, I also, and I'm ad-libbing MLK saying the arc of history bent towards justice. And I've got to hope that in this moment that sort of the you know, the angels will carry American democracy into the next generation.
Well, let me ask you, in the time we have left, respond to this news analysis that I'm looking at here in the New York Times by Charlie Savage. The headline is, Trump keeps losing in court, and you think he'll keep losing in court. But,
yeah.
They write, his legal strategy is winning anyway. As fights over the president's stonewalling of Congress play out slowly in the courts, he is reducing the prospect that voters will learn damaging new facts about him before the 2020 election. So, again, you know, yes, you had this big ruling about that Don McGahn must testify to, you know, Congress, and it was a scathing rebuke of the Department of Justice. But what Savage is writing is, from a realist perspective, Trump is winning despite losing. That's because it is now late November, not May, when McGahn, at Trump's direction, first defied the subpoena, or even August, when the House asked the judge, Judge Jackson, to enforce the subpoena. The proceedings before Judge Jackson consumed nearly a third of the year as she took briefs, conducted oral arguments, and then composed this 120-page opinion. So during all of that, the slow walking itself is a victory for Trump. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, I actually have been thinking a lot about this. I think the Democrats are to blame for that. I think I've been scratching my head and scratching my head. I compiled a list of the number of subpoenas for documents and testimony that have basically are dead in the water because they're being ignored. I don't understand, as a litigator at heart, why Democrats aren't basically moving to compel compliance with each and every one of those subpoenas. Why aren't there 25, 30 parallel lawsuits before these very judges? And the courts can move quickly. We also heard that Judge Kohler-Catelli in the D.C. District Court this week issued a preliminary injunction in a Freedom of Information Act request that seeks documents relating to the decision to withhold the $400 million in Ukrainian aid. A preliminary injunction, by definition, is a quick ruling. You have to basically make your showing, and the argument is, listen, once we get down the road to actually litigating this, we will prove that we have a claim here. The court can issue immediate relief. We also saw this week an appeal by the Trump administration to the United States Supreme Court of the decision by lower courts that his accounting firm has to turn over his tax records. The Supreme Court issued an immediate stay of that ruling, also pretty rare out of the United States Supreme Court. So the Trump administration seems to understand, A, courts can move fast, and B, aggressiveness in courts is important. And I really, Charlie, for the life of me, cannot understand the milquetoast response from House Democrats when it comes to using the third branch of government, the judicial branch, to shore up the power of Congress, the oversight power. And remember, that's the power of the people. That it's respecting the prerogative of the people to know what their government is up to. So I place the blame as much on the Democrats as on the Trump administration that we don't have these facts. We should be hearing from Mulvaney. We should be hearing from Pompeo. We should be hearing from John Bolton. We should be hearing from Bill Barr. We should be hearing from Rudy Giuliani. I mean, these people had firsthand knowledge, as far as we know, of what the president's intents, desires were here with respect to Ukraine. And there hasn't even been an effort.
No,
to get those people to talk.
And I agree with you on the legal strategy, but also from the political point of view, the pushing for that testimony, underlines the main argument that no one is above the law and we should find out what the truth is. If, in fact, the White House has exculpatory evidence, then let these people testify. They are not above the law. They are not immune from the law. This is Congress's one of its most fundamental sacred obligations, the process of impeachment. I understand that they want to get it done quickly, but by not engaging, they do run the risk of looking like they are rushing it and kind of doing it kind of in a half-assed way.
Well, and it also supports the brave witnesses that have come forward, yes, right? And has their back. I was in an Uber before this. I was at, you know, and I did a hit for CBS, and the Uber driver was asked where I was going. I said CBS, asked what I do. I said I'm a legal analyst. And he said, well, what is this impeachment thing? Is it real or is it a witch hunt? That's what he said. And that's just, of course, one person's point of view. But I do agree with you. If you get the federal judiciary saying this is no witch hunt, this is real. This is in the Constitution. This is in the law. This is backed up by precedent. This is how our Constitution and our country was established and framed. I think that that sends a pretty important message to the American people.
You know, this does remind me, in going back to Watergate, a lot of us have focused on that moment in which Republicans went to Richard Nixon and said, your support is gone, you need to go. Obviously a decisive moment, but far, yes, more decisive, really, was the unanimous opinion of, was it unanimous? The opinion of the yes, Supreme Court. Yeah, it was unanimous. The U.S. Supreme Court told Richard Nixon that he had to turn over the tapes. And when you had the ruling from the Supreme Court, that obviously was such a bold underline to what was going on. It was a decisive institutional moment, and from then on, he was done. It was over. So you're saying that what Democrats should be pushing this to have maybe a parallel court ruling, or at least that institutional validation that what they are doing is a fundamental part of the Constitution.
Right, because, you know, when the court, the way this works, right, so there's a congressional subpoena out there, and then it's how do you enforce it, right? If somebody violates a contract, how do you enforce it? You've got to go to court and get a judge to say this person's in violation of the contract. If somebody walks off your job in your kitchen and doesn't, you know, with your deposit, you've got to get a court involved. So if Congress gets a court involved, then you've got an order from a court compelling compliance. If the witness is still refusing to show up for testimony, they're not just in violation of Congress and the subpoena. They are now in violation of a court order. And federal courts can enforce that with the U.S. Marshal Service. They can actually put you in jail. So it is a message to the presidency, to the office, that listen, Congress means business. We are going to fight for our prerogative. And there's no reason. I mean, these are boilerplate motions. You write one, Charlie. I was at DOJ. You write one, you change the name of the witness, you keep filing it. Maybe they all go to the same judge, but the message is we are serious. There's a sheriff in town on behalf of the American people through the Congress. And people that are Trump supporters have to understand, if the next president that is a Democrat that violates norms and rules, that precedent will help the Republican Party get compliance with oversight from the Congress. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I really don't understand why they've been so, the Democrats have just kind of allowed the Trump administration to run roughshod over its subpoena authority. It's just really baffling to me. I as a lawyer and a strategist, I really don't understand it, because they can always, as we saw with Kupperman, right, Bolton's advisor, they subpoenaed him. He asked for a declaratory judgment. They withdrew the subpoena. Tail between their legs. I don't understand it.
Kim Whaley, thanks so much for joining me. Kim Whaley is a CBS legal analyst, contributor to BBC News, author, law professor, former assistant U.S. attorney and associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation, and the author, most recently, of How to Read the Constitution and Why. The why may be the most important thing of all. Kim, thanks for coming back on. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, sure. My pleasure, Charlie. And I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving and vegan turkey and all, or however you do that.
No vegan around here. Thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.